Yeah, seeing a heartbeat, you know, it's very exciting because it really tells you this is no longer hand waving. You know, you're getting an organ filled embryo.
Yeah, and as you know, just recently we got an email from a young 22-year-old woman that very emotionally wrote to us that she lost the ability to procreate because she was diagnosed with cancer and she didn't have time to freeze her egg before she had to undergo chemotherapy. And, you know, people want to have their own babies. And it's very emotional, and hopefully we can solve this problem one day.
If you've listened to this podcast before, you know that NFX is interested in edge case solutions to big problems. We'd like to explore what's happening on the margins of the network before it gets huge. So today, we're highlighting a landmark scientific moment, the ability to grow synthetic embryos without a sperm or egg outside the womb. This breakthrough was published in the scientific journal Cell and was covered by the New York Times, Washington Post, Business Insider, and many more. To explain what this means for the future of TechBio, NFX Bio general partner Amr Jory sat down with the lead author of this work and founder of Renewal Bio, Dr. Jacob Hanna of the Weizmann Institute of Science in Israel. We hope you enjoy this conversation.
So hello everyone, my name is Omri, I'm a GP at NFX, and today we're going to talk about breakthrough science. And we have with us Professor Jacob Hanna from the Weizmann Institute. Hello Jacob.
Hi Omri.
So we just started a new company called Renewal Bio based on the breakthrough technology from your lab. And the world is buzzing about the research that was just published. And this podcast, this NFX podcast, is usually geared toward entrepreneurs and founders. So maybe they don't understand biology much, but you know, this is quite amazing. And I believe one day we'll win the Nobel Prize. So you heard it first here. So today I want to discuss your journey towards creating synthetic embryos. That was a paper that was published in Cell just a month ago. So maybe we can start by your background. You know, where did you start and how did you get to be a professor at Weizmann?
Yeah. Well, thank you for the enthusiasm. We're very excited. We hope, we believe that, this can become something important. So I'm originally trained as a physician. I'm a licensed physician in Israel, but I did a PhD in immunology, actually. And after that, I did a postdoc on stem cells at MIT, right at the time where there was a breakthrough that you can actually take a skin cell or a blood cell and completely reverse it back to become a stem cell. So you don't need to have embryo-derived stem cells. And we've been working on that since, when I was my postdoc from 2007 for 15 years. And overall, we're trying to tackle this big question which faces modern society, and the challenge is really how do we come up with a source for organ transplants and for cell transplant that are identical to the patient. As you know today, if you want to treat a disease and find an organ donor, it's very difficult to find one. And even if you do, the DNA is never identical. So there's always going to be a rejection and you need immune suppression and so forth. So since the discovery of these iPSs 15 years ago, the idea is that now we have stem cells that are identical to the patient. The challenge remains, how do we move forward and make organs and cells for transplantation from them? It is important to emphasize that we cannot take embryonic or these iPS cells and just inject them to the patient. You know, if you put them in the lung, they're not going to become lung cells just by learning from their neighbors. You actually have to differentiate them. You have to make cells that are mature, defined population, and only those you can transplant them. And that actually has proven a very difficult challenge, and that's what we've been trying to solve for the last 12 years.
So last year you published a really interesting paper in Nature where you show you can take natural mouse embryos and grow them ex utero to day 8.5. And again, mouse pregnancy is only 20 days, so it's a big part of the pregnancy. Can you tell us more about that research?
Yeah, so I think it's important to realize why we're doing this and why this is leading up to this. So we're not just like, one morning, let's start growing embryos and so forth. But actually, as I mentioned, we want stem cells to become organs. And to do that, we need to understand and imitate the embryo. How does the embryo makes its organs? But the challenge for this really is that the embryo does this process, what's called gastrulation, which is making the organ progenitors, and organogenesis, which is mature organ formation. It happens right when a small embryo, which is just a ball of stem cells, enters the uterus. So in the mouse, this happens within 5 days. You get entire embryo, which then becomes a fetus because it has its, all its organs. And the uterus is not transparent. We cannot see what's happening. And also at these late stages, even if you take an embryo out, you cannot put it back. So for example, you cannot take it and perturb it and watch what is the outcome. And this is even in mice. If you're talking about human beings, this is, we're completely in the dark, because usually you're talking about stages in pregnancy that are so early that usually a woman doesn't know she's pregnant at all. So that's why we decided to really think, can we grow, make basically mammalian embryos like zebrafish or frogs, meaning grow outside the uterus? And this is also a fundamental question, you know, can you get capture, gastrulation and organogenesis outside the mammalian uterus? Is it possible at all? And what we published last year really was the end result of a very long 8-year study, where we basically developed a platform which consists of an electronic device and also the media conditions to grow these embryos, because you don't have a uterus and maternal blood supply. And the system is basically, you can think of it as a ventilation machine. We're not ventilating the mouse lung, but actually ventilating the environment of the embryo. And we learned over the years what are the parameters that are critical to really get the embryos growing, such as, for example, also pressure, controlled exposure to light, and so forth. And also, what are the nutrients in the media that need to make this embryo grow? And really, what that paper really showed, that you know, this was a big jump from before, where you could grow embryos maybe for one day and the embryos were actually abnormal. You can go from day 5 to day 11 in the mouse embryo. So this is 6 days, which is about a third of mouse pregnancy. But again, this is the critical phases that we're after, because this is exactly from pre-gastrulation to late organogenesis. We can really see the entire continuum of this happening outside the uterus. So this taught us as a principle, really, that really you can capture entire organ formation in mammals outside the uterus. It shows you that the embryo is self-organizing in a way. So the pattern, or what's called the morphogens, which makes the morph, meaning in Latin, the shape of the embryo, is dictated by the embryo itself and not by the uterus. And then the uterus, of course, is very efficient and important, but it's actually more about metabolic supply, which we can substitute in that regard. So that was really the study last year, but also it constituted, I would say, the bottleneck for the entire field, because it solved the bottleneck, which led us to the current study, where you actually, what happens, you know, if you put aggregates of stem cells, or you can call them organoids or embryoids from stem cells, what if you put them in this device, what would happen? Because you can think that the field of this, what's called synthetic embryos, so these are cell embryos that are made from stem cells, unlike, you know, what we call natural embryos, which are made after fertilization of sperm and egg. That field was really stuck because you had, you know, a lot of great papers making, you know, small aggregates of stem cells, like very, very early embryos that do not have any organs. But you couldn't know, are these real embryos? Can they become organ-filled embryos, basically? And that is because, well, if you cannot grow a natural embryo outside, you know, how are you going to be able to grow synthetic embryos? So basically, what we did last year becomes what I call the positive control or the reference control. So now we know what it takes. We know what are the conditions that are needed to allow a mouse embryo, in this case, to go through gastrulation or organogenesis. So we know what it takes. And the question was, what happens if we put stem cells, and the question, which type of stem cells, in this setting, and would they make something that is similar to an embryo or not? So last year really was the technology and the platform, the bottleneck, and now, which I guess is the most important result in the current study, which really allowed, which showed actually, quite simply, that the same conditions, the same device, the same media, the same parameters, that if you take stem cells, what we call them naive, in a naive state, really the stem cells that are grown in a state that is very similar to the earliest stages in the embryo. They can start growing. We start with like a clump of 25 cells, and alone over a process of 8 days, they start organizing themselves into an embryo-like structure. And if we learned last year that embryos are self-organizing to make their organs, now we're learning that stem cells are self-organizing to make embryo-like structures, which are self-organizing to develop and make organs. And this context, I think we can reach, as I mentioned, day 8.5. And 8.5 in development, it is after gastrulation, post-gastrulation, and already well into organ formation. So therefore, these embryos have brains, including the anterior region, the mid region. They have neural tube. They have a heart with chambers that is beating. They have blood stem cells. They have the intestinal tube, and they have the tail. And we did a lot of characterization really to show, I would say, that these embryos are not totally normal. I would say about perhaps 90-95% similar to natural embryos. But definitely they are by far the most sophisticated, the most advanced differentiation entities, because they really capture the sequence of events and the way the organs are placed inside the embryo in relation to each other is very, very physiological state.
So that's so super exciting. Can you remember how you felt going to the lab day after day, looking at the result, like, oh my God, this is actually working? Can you remember that?
Unfortunately, no. And I think that I know that this is perhaps a disappointing answer. And I always say, because this is for two reasons. This has been, as I said, like perhaps a very long process of working for 12 days, where every time we actually got one more day and increased the efficiency and increased the quality. And a bad habit that we have is, you know, of course we get excited, but within 1 hour, we're actually thinking, what about the next step? So this has really, of course, it has been very exciting. And, you know, yes, but then on the other hand, yeah, seeing a heartbeat, you know, is very exciting, because it really tells you this is no longer hand waving, you know, you're getting an organ-filled embryo. But the I think really the magic, which is great, has been, you know, just continuous, slow, but persistent progress in seeing how these develop, whether it's natural embryos, whether it's synthetic embryos from the mouse. And, you know, we work on other species, for example, from rabbits and so forth. So really seeing this expanding has been very exciting. And also, as what's also been exciting is really seeing different aspects that we did do research in the lab merged together, really, to culminate into this one climax. In other words, so it's not about, hasn't been only, as I mentioned, about how to grow embryos and build a device, but actually learning how to make what we call naive stem cells, particularly in humans and other species. So naive stem cells are really the highest levels of stemness. And for years, people, you know, when we were working on these naive stem cells, was like, oh, why should we care? We have conventional stem cells. They're good anyways. But we now, you know, we've showed before that conventional stem cells are limited in their potential. And now, actually, we show that this can only work by using naive stem cells. And so that's, you know, this kind of the merger between the those two paths, which was perhaps, you know, not always clear, is in itself also very exciting for us, and also gives us a lot of knowledge and control really to make our results better, because we're very well versed in both aspects of this stem cell field.
So currently, you published fully synthetic mouse embryos, so no sperm, no egg, no uterus, from day zero to day 8.5 out of 20 days. Why just 8.5? Mm-hmm. Why not 9.5? Why not 20 days? Do you think in the future you can get synthetic embryos growing all the way?
So that's an excellent question. So as I mentioned, in natural embryos we publish, we can reach day 11.5. I can share with you, actually, we also reach day 13.5. And it is interesting why in synthetic embryos we could reach only 8.5 versus if we went one day later, they became not normally developed, so we couldn't call them, you know, an embryo or an equivalent embryo. And we believe that this is, you know, perhaps I still believe it's a suboptimal way of the protocol. I think that I have no reason to believe that these embryos cannot go further. Because I think once you already finished gastrulation, you can see all the organs, they should proceed further. I think what's happening in the embryo, because as I mentioned, there are some subtle malformations. For example, perhaps in some embryos, the heart is too big or too small, or the brain is slightly too big or too small. And that actually adds up and the embryo doesn't grow further. And the challenge is really how can we perhaps better confine the embryos and do some tricks to really make them aggregate in a better way. And I believe they can catch up with natural embryos. Whether we can, you know, get entire, let's say we talk about in mouse pregnancies, more of an entire pregnancy outside the uterus, it hasn't been, I must say, a major focus of our lab because, as I mentioned, we're trying to look at how organ formation happens. We are now starting to work on this on mice. And one advantage is that although there's no maternal blood supply here, but these embryos have an umbilical cord and have a placenta and have blood supply. So basically, you already have what you call it the highway roads to really try perhaps and use circulation on these embryos. Now, I would think this is... feasible for mouse because mouse is very small and for 20 days of pregnancy. And when you're talking to larger animals, you're talking about bovine, monkeys, even humans one day, I don't think this is really possible. I think the embryos are too big. It's too long, as far-fetched at the moment. We prefer actually at the moment to focus on the early stages from different species, including humans, because it's more about understanding how organ progenitors are formed and perhaps even, you know, using these organ progenitors that emerge in this process for transplantation and research.
So let's talk about that part, because I think, people think about company formation. You start a company to commercialize the technology and to create products for people that suffers. So yeah. What kind of diseases or indication, what kind of suffering can we prevent in the world using this technology if we just imagine how the future can look like?
Yeah. So I think this is a very important question. I think, it's very important to all remember and remind ourselves that this is our goal in the end, that we're trying to make early cell progenitors that are used for transplantations. And the scenario that we are really facing, you can think of an adult woman who's infertile either because of unknown causes or from undergoing chemotherapy at a younger age, or women, in modern society, perhaps, after age of 38, the quality of eggs really deteriorates. That's one scenario. You could think of other scenarios where you have a patient who needs bone marrow transplant or a liver transplant, and he cannot find a matched donor. With these ones. And that's why what we want to explore in the company, and we think there is merit and there is rationale based on what we know from mouse experiments and also what we know with conventional differentiation of stem cells, is that we can envision a scenario where such a patient will come and just donate, whether it's a drop of blood or a hair. We already know how to make these iPS cells. We then put them and make them in this naive state that I mentioned, which is really the most pristine and most potent cell, and then try to push them to self-organize into what we would call the synthetic whole embryoid model, what we call them in brief SWIMs. This kind of early differentiation for about, let's say, 20 or 30 days, which we already know, for example, germ cells or blood stem cells are already found at such early stages. And in this case, whether these cells can be taken, perhaps expanded or modified if needed, and then transplanted back to that patient. That is the scenario that we're trying to do, and I think this is what has the field been after. So that could be, in this scenario, it could be an easy way where you can have genetically matched, patient-specific stem cells that self-organize into complex, authentic, differentiated cells that can be used further, either, as I said, for transplantation or drug discovery and so forth.
Yeah, and as you know, just recently we got an email from a young 22-year-old woman that, very emotionally wrote to us that she lost the ability to procreate because she was diagnosed with cancer and she didn't have time to freeze her egg before she had to undergo chemotherapy. And, you know, people want to have their own babies. And it's very emotional, and hopefully we can solve this problem one day.
No, something, you know, as I said, I've seen in the clinic from my physician training as a physician, but as I mean, I've been, you know, getting such emails and for years about this, and there and other ways, and in general in the field. And I think, you know, the stem cells, when they say, oh, there's the stem cell promise, and, you know, where why hasn't been so much progress? So I would say there has been a lot of progress. And I think the cells can do it. And I think there's very, you know, when you see these cells self-organized into an embryo, you realize that the cells can do the job. It's that we need to learn how to control them in a way and use them for this benefit. So this is, I think it provides a new path of getting at this problem. I think it's a very strong and valid path. And it's a very unique one. And that's what we would like to explore in many different directions and see what it can be good for.
Amazing, really, truly amazing. And in NFX, we like to support scientist founders. And in this company, you know, there are two kind of scientist founders. Of course, you're a scientist in Weizmann Institute. You're staying at Weizmann. You're still doing a lot of amazing basic research while helping the company. So I'd love to hear what's your experience been so far. And then your students, you know, they did their PhD. They did postdoc. Some of them went to industry, some to academy. And now many of them are coming back to work on this project. You know, what do you think about this journey of a scientist founder?
I think I must say it's a very exciting one. You know, this is the first company that I'm involved in co-founding, and I think probably is the last one. And for me, the reason is that, you know, trying to make something, this is something I'm very, very committed to. I think this has been a goal after, and I think, you know, this is high time really to try to push this. And the company is not, it's also, of course, about trying to commercialization, but the company can also push the science very much forward. And this is a learning experience for me. It's been, you know, very, very good one so far, and really challenging and putting the plan. But really what, as you mentioned, what has been most special is that, being able to recruit former students from my lab that went on and actually became experts in other fields. You know, one of them is actually now become a very expert in hematopoietic stem cells. One other is really expert in transplantation in pigs of certain organs. So actually that's really exciting because, it's watching them mature. They have even knowledge in things that far beyond what I do have. And we know each other, and it's nice to kind of get work together at the higher level in some end, and this kind of enthusiasm and many, many ideas together. And so I think it's also a very healthy way and fun way of doing it.
Yeah. And some places like the Weizmann Institute are like the bastions of like basic science and all the ethics, you know, all the setting up scientists to focus just on basic science. But my experience in companies like Mammoth Bioscience, where Jennifer Donda is the co-founder, that obviously you can still be an amazing curiosity driven basic scientist and start companies. Mm-hmm. And some of your students can go start companies, and some of your students can go become amazing scientists, and your companies can give you resources back to the lab so you can do more science. And so I think for my experience, it's a win-win for a scientist.
Actually, I mean, you can add one. When you were talking about the Weizmann Institute, about the basic research, I think the Weizmann actually, you know, you can do research whatever you want, whether it's basic, whether applied, and these things. And this is very curiosity driven. But, you know, what always proves itself again and again, as you mentioned, whether it was the CRISPR from before, and that basic science typically goes hands in hands, and this understanding leads to development that are highly applied. And I think in our example, really learning about what does it mean to be a naive cell, and what is the signaling pathway for a naive cell, and really trying to be curious why you can't grow an embryo at late stages. And then, of course, that develops into an applied thing, which helps you go back and answer a basic thing. So particularly in the stem cell field, I think we are lucky because we're always, you know, going, you know, we're, uh, uh, go, together, you know, we're doing two things most of the time. You know, it's both sides of the coins. We're advancing basic knowledge that helps advance technology that goes back again and feeds in and increasing our knowledge of basic research. And I think this is what's happening for us in this case, and very helpful for us. And we will continue, that's why, to answer basic questions on this process.
Amazing. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you very much. It will be exciting.